Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Brim.
And today we're discussing scene 27, which we're going to call Anyone Else?
Question mark.
Anyone Else? Question mark. Yeah, because once again, this is a scene that we don't really have a title for because of the way we're dividing them. So that's what we're going with. Before we get into it, I have an email I'd like to read. This is from Hunter. The subject is Love Your Podcast. And they say, Dear Brittany and Ethan, thank you so much for doing your wonderful podcast. I just discovered it in the last week by searching through podcasts for Titanic-related content. For the past couple of weeks, I've been in the midst of reigniting my lifelong Titanic obsession after a friend and I played an Escape the Crate, basically a series of escape rooms in a box that is Titanic-themed. That sounds cool.
I think I've seen that before.
Huh. So they continue. I've been a passionate Titanic enthusiast ever since I was 7 years old, the year the film was released. I begged my mom to take me to see it in theaters, but she understandably decided not to take a 7-year-old to a 3-plus-hour romance movie. When I finally did see it on VHS, I became, to her surprise, immediately entranced with it, and it automatically became a lifelong favorite movie, just like you had described, Brittany. Then I got all sorts of books about Titanic and even a point-and-click adventure computer game called Titanic Adventure Out of Time, which I just rediscovered in the last 2 weeks, too. Needless to say, I just rewatched the film twice, and your podcast has been an amazing companion. Thanks, Hunter.
Aww. Yeah, that was cool.
Cool to think, like, we make a good movie companion podcast.
I mean, like, wait till he reads our book.
That book that's definitely coming out. But again, I think it's very interesting that that was pretty much exactly my story as well.
Yeah.
But it was like the same sort of thing. Like the mother said no, that, you know, she would take him to see it and then eventually did see it on VHS and just became obsessed with it. It's just really weird. I'll never really get it. I mean, of course I get it because it happened to me, but it's just crazy that so many other people out there had pretty much the same exact experience as a child.
Well, not being able to see it or not being allowed to see it kind of creates the mystique already. So that's already there.
Yeah, I definitely think that's what happened to me.
And then it delivers on the mystique too, which is cool. And we've talked about how the movie has a very unique tone and it's like haunting in a lot of parts, especially later on. But,
you know, I was pretty sure it was my first movie that I had seen. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it was going to be crazy for my five-year-old mind.
I mean, even for me, it's not quite the same, but I wasn't allowed to see it when I was a kid, and then I saw it as an older person. I was like 20, and I thought it was awesome. I was like, man, this would have been one of my favorite movies as a kid. I don't call Titanic my favorite like you guys do, but, like, you know, it's definitely one of my, I have a lot of favorites, but it's one I love. But it's the same kind of journey, but just stretched out longer. And, you know, I didn't watch it for the first time as a kid, so it didn't really hit me as hard, because it is definitely something that when you watch younger to it, you react to it even bigger because you're like, holy mackerel, like the thing that these people went through. Yeah, it is interesting though how a lot of people have that same journey.
Mm-hmm. At such a young age, that's what's the crazy thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the magic of this movie. I don't know what James Cameron put in it, but he put something in it. I don't know. Some mystical rays that come off of the screen and go into children's brains. But yeah, so thank you, Hunter. Appreciate hearing from you. And that's so cool that the podcast has been a nice companion for your rewatches.
Definitely.
So getting into the scene. So it opens with another incredible wide shot of the Titanic sinking. And I love how when I take my notes, I like to take them late at night, the night before we record, because for some reason my mind is just kind of racing a little bit around that time. Like, you know, around like midnight.
Yeah, totally. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like when I take notes, I think of things that I probably wouldn't have thought of another time in the day.
When I have to watch a movie that I have to write about, I prefer watching it at nighttime, because just the way my brain is really, really, I focus way more on it. You don't have to think about anything you have to do later also. So
Yep. I feel like I'm like maybe just a little bit overtired. So it helps my mind just kind of be a little loopy with not thinking too much about what I'm writing down. Just writing literally whatever pops into my head. Sometimes it's really good what my mind at midnight thinks of. But yeah, I just thought of in this moment how I feel like we've probably mentioned it before, but Cameron, like he's showing us the macro, right? Mm-hmm. Like he keeps cutting back to these wide shots, right? He keeps reminding us of the macro part of the situation. But then he cuts right back in to the micro.
Yeah.
When we start the scene, you know, it starts with that wide shot and then it cuts to everybody on the deck waiting to get on lifeboats. And one of the first things you see is a little girl being handed over into the lifeboat. I don't know. There's something about that that struck me this time. You know, it's so easy to look at the big ship and from those shots, everybody looks like ants. But then he does, you know, he cuts right back in to be like, no, these are people. Just reminding you.
Those are the two layers of the film. It's easy to think of the movie and just think of the ship sinking and all the people falling off of it and drowning and the lifeboats going away. And, you know, earlier on, just the dining room and, all, and the set pieces and stuff. And you can also think of the movie just in terms of Jack and Rose. Mm-hmm. Those two different sides of the movie, too, the macro and the micro, kind of help to compartmentalize the two, I guess, but at the same time connect them.
Right. Because we've said before, like, everyone's so used to the macro when it comes to Titanic. Like, it's literally Titanic. It's Titanic-sized.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just something about this particular cut just kind of struck me as like, wow, yeah, literally here's the macro and here's the micro. When it cuts in to everybody on deck, we see that little girl being handed over into the lifeboat as Light Toller shoots some warning shots into the air and continues to request women and children only. And then the camera just kind of glides over to Jack and Rose, who are right next to Light Toller. And again, my midnight brain just thought it was cool how, you know, Jack and Rose fit in to the historical fiction thing right there. You know what I mean?
That's true too, yeah.
I was in the moment, you know, I was looking at the Titanic with this wide shot and then you're in there, all the, you know, passengers getting on lifeboats and then suddenly the camera just gives us Jack and Rose. They're just two of the people among the big crowd. This is still the story of Titanic, but Jack and Rose are in there and that doesn't diminish the story of Titanic.
It's like she's not in the scene. It's like all this stuff though with Molly Brown, who's arguably the most famous figure from who was on the ship, I think. And yeah, so like putting, they're in a lot of scenes with her and she's very integral in certain aspects of their story. So like that's cool too. And just showing that they were seamlessly working them into these actual events. It's pretty cool.
You know, for the moment, a very like standard practice thing that's going on for, you know, a sinking ship, just getting people on lifeboats and everybody congregating, that they're just there. They're just among the people. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
Especially to have them like right next to Light Toller in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack and Rose are waiting for a boat. And at this moment, you know, I think Jack was hoping that he could get on the boat with Rose, potentially, because he's looking at what's going on and he's seeing Light Toller shouting for women and children only. Step back, sir. Come through, madam. And Jack turns around to Tommy and Fabrizio and says, you should check the other side. you know, go quick. So Tommy and Fabrizio run to see if there's any chance for them on the other side of the ship.
Leo could pass as a little boy.
I know. A lot of people think that. And it's so funny because obviously I never thought that when I was a kid. Like, when you're a kid, everybody looks so much older than you anyway.
He's older, yeah.
And so to me, I still look at him and I still see him the way I saw him as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
But then sometimes I take a step back and I look at him the way other people are if they just see it. Like if you're so used to 40-year-old Leonardo DiCaprio and then you go back and look at him 21, 22 years old in this movie, he does look like a newborn baby, I gotta say.
Yeah, he looks very, very young, yeah. Totally.
I think I saw a picture of, it was like a screenshot of him before the first class dinner when he was leaning against one of the pillars, you know, when he's waiting for Rose to come down from the stairs. And someone had shared it, and they were like, why does Leo look like a middle schooler? Like, I don't remember this.
I was getting ready to go on the kickball field.
He really did. He was making like kind of a little pouty face or something. I was like, he does look like a little baby. But yeah, he was kind of lucky like that in his career where he could play younger roles the older he got. Like, he was playing a 16-year-old in Catch Me If You Can. I swear to God, wasn't that character? He was supposed to be in high school for sure.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, wow. And that was a few years after Titanic. It was like 5 or 6 years later. I think it was like 02.
Yeah, he was playing a character at least 10 years younger than him, I'd say.
Yeah, wow. Good movie, by the way.
I love that movie. Yeah, I just rewatched it again recently. It's so good. That's probably my favorite Leo movie other than Titanic.
Probably me too. That or The Revenant.
Anyway, small tangent on the youthfulness of Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. So Tommy and Fabrizio go running off to check the other side of the ship to see if there's any chance for them over there. The camera kind of holds on Rose for a moment while she looks straight ahead at this, you know, impending moment in her life. Once again, she's going to be faced with another decision of literally getting on the lifeboat or staying on the sinking ship once again. But yeah, so the camera holds on her for a minute. And for some reason, this shot always stood out to me as well. And I just think Kate looks especially beautiful in this shot. I don't know what it is about it. She has this look on her face where she's a little scared, but also there's like a little bit of determination in there for some reason. And I don't know. I don't really have how to describe the look on her face, but
a lot of complex emotions for everyone in the scene has like a choice to make, which is cool. I know it's not like a technical definitive scene. Well, it is, but you know what I mean?
All of the things we're discussing today in this episode, it's all choices.
Yeah, it's all choices. All three character groups, I think, or three characters have a choice to make it at some regard.
So we see them preparing another distress flare to put off. And according to the historians, there were 8 that were fired that night. Lovejoy passes by, and I was just laughing. Because once again, Lovejoy. Okay, so he returns to Cal, right?
Yeah.
After apparently being sent on another mission to find Rose.
This guy's insane.
Yeah, so he returns, and he returns to Cal with the following news and the following sentence of how he says it. So he says,
I found her on the other side, waiting for a boat with him.
Never mind how he got out of the handcuffs.
I know, they don't even know like any of that yet, right? It's weird, because as we're talking about it as it goes, you know, obviously I also know everything that's happened, but it's hard to remember sometimes. I'm like, wait, what do they know of the situation? Do they even know? Like, to their knowledge, Jack is still handcuffed, right?
Yeah, like, because the key...
Well, yeah, because Lovejoy kept the key.
He kept the key, right? The key and so pocket. It was like... Yeah. So in his head, he's like, how in the world did he get free without a key? I don't know.
That's almost funnier, because now he's like, with him, this guy just won't die.
Yeah, as a cockroach, man. Yeah.
How the heck did he get off from the pipe? God, is this guy magic? Like, what's going on? But anyway, but I was just laughing in particular, because in our last episode, we talked about, you know, why does Lovejoy hate Jack so much?
Yeah.
The level of disgust in his voice when he said, with him, I was like, what is the vendetta? I was like, does he really just hate Jack that much just because Cal does?
He hates him more than Cal does.
I think he might.
Regardless if Cal hated him or not, I think he would still hate him or something. I don't know. It's it's an interesting character study, actually, if you really break it down, because you can really kind of go into meditation on why Lovejoy has these motives, but it's so weird. And he just inexplicably risks his life here, too.
Right?
It's so weird.
So, okay, this is another thing I wanted to say. You know, I've said it before, but like I'll say it again, I guess. You know, we're discussing it in the context of the movie. Mm. You know, all of these people as characters in this movie, even the historical ones. So as we get into this scene with Murdoch and stuff like that, obviously we'll be sharing historical information as it's necessary, but we're mostly looking at all of this based on what is happening on screen, what has happened leading up to this, and analyzing these characters as characters in the movie. Anything we say isn't like, you know, this is what the real Murdoch was thinking. You know, it's like, no, this is what James Cameron's Murdoch might have been thinking or whatever in the context of this film.
You know, it'll be pretty clear when we're talking about the real people, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I always make a point to distinguish. So, yeah, so the disgust from Lovejoy with Jack, it was just... if anything, he takes that valet job very seriously.
Give him a raise, why don't you? Yeah, this is so interesting, this whole scene with Cal.
You said give him a raise. I mean, man, this guy has gone on personal missions for Cal more than once. Cal just tells Lovejoy, find her, and just like sends...
Lovejoy, you get to keep the Picasso painting.
I mean, think about it. He sent Lovejoy to look for her at the third class party. He sent Lovejoy to look for her when he ended up chasing them around the ship.
Just now. And then he was watching, babysitting him when he was handcuffed.
He was doing that for him.
I was really fascinated with this sequence right here with Cal, and I was really interested in the music during this whole scene and just how it changes. It was kind of guiding you to his dilemma instead of, because there's times when like you notice the music and it's like, okay, I don't like noticing it in this situation, but or it feels manipulative. But here it kind of was guiding you through this dilemma that he has and kind of made you think about it more and analyze it in a different way. And he almost gets on this thing and the lifeboat. You're thinking about what does Cal, is it his pride? Does he actually have a like remnants of love in there for Rose? Or like,
yes,
it's very interesting. And the relationship that he has with Rose kind of gets put in a light that's not so black and white. Like it's been the whole movie. Like the whole movie, it's like, okay, she's like, obviously doesn't love him. But he's like possessive and he's controlling. But in this moment, it separates from that black and white and just makes you think about it. And it was interesting. And it's really the only time where you think about it.
Well, there's more coming.
Okay.
But
so far, it's the only time. Yeah.
But yeah, I have that later in my notes. Yeah. We'll get into that. But yeah, so in this moment, and you're right about the music, which leads up to his decision here.
Yeah, and it kind of like, it holds you. The music holds you, and you're like, whoa, what's he going to do?
It is guiding you, I guess, like you said. And then right before he makes the decision, it drops out and it's silent, and like you're waiting.
Exactly. It's tension. Yeah, it holds you. Yeah, it's so good. The music in this scene was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So Cal looks conflicted a little bit by Lovejoy's news here.
Yeah.
And I could have sworn, I'm going to go back right now and just double check, because on my little CRT TV, which I had watched this scene on to take my notes, I could have sworn I saw a little smile flash across his face, but...
From Lovejoy?
On Cal's.
On Cal's face. Huh.
Maybe just like the faintest of smiles when he says that Lovejoy found her.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So then that, again, kind of supports what you said about, you know, is there a little bit of love in there?
Yeah.
But let me double check.
Because this is a sliding glass door moment for him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like a few different emotions flashing across his face, I think.
Yeah.
Very small glimmers of small happiness, relief, a little bit of like, you know, here's my chance to get on a boat kind of thing.
Like, she is giving me an out. Like, if she obviously loves this guy. Like, I have an out, I don't have to, but it's there's also maybe he feels a responsibility to go get, like, save her or something, you know what I mean? Like,
Well, I feel like we're getting ahead of ourselves as well, because there is a little bit more to talk about before we get to that moment. Okay. But yeah, so Cal, he looks conflicted by Lovejoy's news, but he's also standing there waiting for a boat.
Yeah.
I never thought about that before. I was like, okay, would he have gotten on this boat if Lovejoy just couldn't find her?
That's true, right?
Would he have gotten on this boat without Lovejoy?
Yeah.
Or was he just waiting for him to come back and they were going to get on the boat regardless of what the... Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. He might have just assumed Rose got on a lifeboat because they were basically just letting all the women on. And she was a first-class woman on top of it, so...
And then I was thinking... Again, in the context of the movie, maybe he was expecting Murdoch to, like, hold the boat for him as well, too, or something?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Because why else would he be waiting there if he was partially hoping to maybe find Rose or waiting for Lovejoy or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he's bribing him. He's attempting to bribe him. So he obviously wants to get on the boat. But yeah, it's interesting. Definitely a lot to think about.
Yeah. So historically, though, we've mentioned Murdoch was letting men onto his boats. He would get all of the women and children on, and then if there were any men around who could fit on, sure. So Murdoch asks if there are any more women and children, and Ismay is there, and he says that they're all aboard. I think that's important to mention as well, because before we get to what happens with Ismay, you know, he has this reputation of being a coward. He didn't really do much to help. He was thinking of himself. You know, I feel like that's kind of the narrative surrounding him. But if you look in the background, he's helping people.
Yeah.
He's helping people get onto that boat, and he's very frantic about it, and he's trying. He's like, here you go, like, get on. You yeah. know, like, you know. And
well, because he is probably, I mean, it might be a self-serving altruism. You know, oh, I got to help these people. The fewer casualties, the less harsh this is going to look for me. And then I think maybe the opportunity opens up for him to get on. It's either, like, his reputation or his life, I guess, and I don't know.
Yeah, we're not there yet either.
Yeah. But it's connected. I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. I think it is interesting that he's helping people, but there's probably some MO knowing his character, how we've learned about his character. I don't know about him in real life.
Earlier on, you could see him doing that in the background as well.
Okay.
When Cal bribed Murdoch to begin with and stuffed the money in his pocket, you can see Ismay in the background really briefly, like, grabbing a woman across the deck and, like, bringing her over to the boat.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, like, the fewer casualties, the better he looks too.
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like historically speaking, some people don't like how black and white Ismay tends to be portrayed, so yeah. I just wanted to point out that Cameron did include that in the background of these shots. You know, that
got
he,
it.
That
okay. He, so then it might have been on purpose, yeah, for Cameron.
You know what I mean? That he was actually doing yeah. something, you know?
Interesting. Okay. We haven't really seen... He's not evil. He's just kind of like a little misguided, I think.
But he's often painted as evil, I feel like. You know what I mean?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. So I think it might have been just a James Cameron's conscience type of thing, and he was like, okay. Like, I can't... Like, he's not... He isn't the villain, I don't think, here. He's not... You know, he's just an antagonist, but I don't... He's not the villain in this
Well, we'll get story. To that, too. James Cameron had a little something to say about that.
Really? Okay.
Like, so we'll get to that.
Okay.
Ismay says that all of the available women and children in that area are already on board this lifeboat, so Murdoch decides to ask for anyone else then, in general, before specifically turning around to Cal and raising his eyebrows, looking at Cal like a little, you know, anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
Like, hint, hint, right? Didn't you bribe me?
Yeah.
Like, this is your chance?
Tempting him, yeah.
I mean, because that's how... You know, in our last episode, that's what Lauren said. You know, that's how she always viewed this scene.
Yeah.
That's how it always came across to me as well. Because, again, in the context of the movie, we're led to believe that a bribe had taken place here. So you would think that if they're going to have Murdoch specifically turn around to Cal, who we know gave him money to secure a place on a boat, and he's looking directly at him, asking for anyone else, wink, wink, basically, you know. But then, the fact that it's not like he wasn't letting men on his boat anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not like Cal had to bribe his way on to a boat that was only for women and children. And like that was the incentive to be like, hey, let me on this boat. I'll give you money. I know it's just women and children, but if I give you money, let me on. It's not that situation. Like, men were getting let on anyway. He probably would have let Cal on that boat without being bribed, you know, without money. So it kind of falls apart a little bit when you think of it like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably, yeah.
But at the same time, it could have just been insurance for a spot on a boat, period. Like, kind of going back to maybe Murdoch would have held the boat for him. Like, hey, I gave you money to ensure that I would be able to have a spot on this boat.
Yeah.
Like, regardless. I don't know.
It might just be like a hole.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that. And then we actually got an email. Why did my voice crack like that? We got an email from someone just recently after our last episode with Lauren Cohen, and they wrote to us regarding this whole bribe thing, and they mentioned their perspective on the matter, which is something I never really thought about before. So the email's from Wendy. She said, if Cal had shown up at that point, he would have been led on even without an attempt at a bribe, which we just mentioned. And then she says, Murdoch doesn't hold back the lifeboat in any way to ensure Cal gets on. So again, there was that.
Okay, yeah.
And then to them, they said, to me, his anyone else then line to Cal read as mockery. He later says that Cal's money can't save either of them in a scene that we haven't gotten to yet. As a senior officer and as a man who spent most of his life at sea, he probably knew he was going to die. It wouldn't have just suddenly occurred to him at the very end.
He's low on the totem pole, so he's probably, if anyone's going to die, it's going to be the passengers in first class who are first priority, just the passengers in general, and then the workers are going to be next, yeah.
Their point is that he must have known this, yeah. And so he wouldn't have even really been thinking about a bribe anyway, because he probably knows that this isn't going to end well for him. So why even entertain it at all, you know? Yeah. She goes on to say that she doesn't think that he ever really accepted the bribe, and thinks that the actor's performance from the start plays as baffled, shock, and disbelief, like a 20th century I can't even. Murdoch is having the worst night of his life and is tasked with trying to save as many people as he can from what he knows is certain death, for which he kind of helped cause because he was the one on duty when they struck the iceberg. He simply does not have the mental bandwidth to address this twit blessed with nothing but daddy's money and God-given audacity. I also think Cal is meant to be a foil to the much more dignified men of first class who made no attempts to get into lifeboats and certainly didn't try to bribe their way onto one.
Yeah. It's not, it's like, it's bad enough that a lot of them are going to die. Now he has to manage egos of, like, he's not Lovejoy, right? Lovejoy is willing to serve the wealthy or whatever, but like this dude's just like, he takes the bribe. I mean, it's not clear if he takes the bribe, but it's like, if he takes the bribe, he's just like, whatever, I don't care. Like, I got bigger fish to fry here, dude.
Cause that's how I always saw it. Like, even if he is silently kind of accepting the bribe, like that's kind of what, that is what is implied, I think.
Yeah.
You know, based off of everything and what we're seeing. I know Wendy, who emailed us, does not think that. And I feel like every interpretation is valid. I mean, because everybody can interpret something however they want. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, judging from things that James Cameron has said and the historians, I mean, I'm pretty sure Murdoch accepting the bribe was the intention, to accept the bribe on some level. They didn't want to do it outright. They wanted it to be vague enough.
Well, then if he's going to let them on the boats anyway, then I guess if you want to pay me, sure, like, screw you.
That's what I thought, too. I was like, okay, so if you're going to give me money to do what I was going to do anyway,
yeah, then
sure.
Exactly. You could see it as that easily.
So James Cameron definitely, I think, you know, the intention was to make Murdoch accept a bribe. And I realized with some comments now from the commentary as we get into, you know, more of this back end of the movie, as there are some more historical things to mention, I think if we can hear this stuff from the source of the historians or James Cameron, like these more longer-winded statements, I think it would be beneficial to hear it from the source on the podcast instead of me just taking notes and reading the paragraph that they said.
Yeah.
It is an extra layer of editing work to rip the commentary, but I think it's worth it in certain...
I'll do it.
Yeah, I think it's worth it in certain situations. So this is what James Cameron had to say about this.
And this is in the area where First Officer Murdoch is loading one of the last boats to be properly launched from the ship. This is Collapsible C. And Murdoch actually allowed a lot of men to get onto his boats. Lightoller didn't. Lightoller was women and children only. With Murdoch, he was shoving men in. It was not a problem. So it's logical that Kel and Lovejoy could have gotten off with Murdoch. But the implication that Murdoch would have accepted a bribe, I feel a little bad about that because Murdoch was a real hero. And I know that some of his family members were a little incensed about some of the things that we showed in the film, and I would apologize to them because I think the guy was a stud. He really saved a lot of lives that night.
So yeah.
So that was your interview with James Cameron?
Yeah, that was James Cameron on the podcast exclusive. No, that's literally on many DVDs out there. But yeah, so that's what he had to say about that. So he says there is definitely an implication of Murdoch accepting a bribe. And, you know, there because of that, you know, it didn't go over well with his family and other people. So it's interesting. So this is all connected now to Cal because he's still there. In our conversation, he hasn't left yet. So he remains conflicted. So Murdoch had turned to him and asked anyone else. And as you were saying, the music, it's kind of leading up to this moment. And then it kind of ends on the kind of a hopeful chord. It's like, duh, and it like leaves it open.
Yeah.
And he has a little flash of a smile on his face, thinking like, oh, right, this is my chance. And then he decides against it.
Hop on, sir. Hop on.
Anyone else?
Do hurry. Hurry along.
Stand by the falls.
Oh, God damn it, all to hell.
Again, decisions, and this was the decision he made. I also want to say, so his quote, right, that he says before he decides against it is, God damn it to hell.
Yeah, yeah.
But once again, as we've said about this movie, people's pronunciations, people's line delivery in this movie, there's so many quirks to it.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since childhood, I did not know what Cal was saying here.
Yeah, he shoves it together.
What I thought he was saying is, God, that damn hotel.
Should have stayed in the hotel instead.
As a kid,
there was
like,
a perfectly fine hotel in Ireland.
I was like, is he calling the Titanic a hotel? Yeah. He's like, he's saying like, damn this hotel. I'm like, what? Because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
He says, God, that damn hotel.
Yeah, it's a very... He for sure slurs it and stuff, yeah.
Yep.
That's funny. Oh, I was going to say something, too. When he turns and the music drops out like that, it kind of puts the audience in a position where it asks us, like, what do we want to happen to him? Do we want him to be saved? Him being saved means he's not going to be messing with Rose and Jack anymore. But him going to go over to Rose and Jack and do whatever he's about to do, like, that also means that he's on the ship longer and, you know, he might reach a different fate. So it's just an interesting thing to ask the audience to ponder what they want to happen in that situation.
Mm. Again, I think Cameron does show Murdoch as being preoccupied.
Yeah.
He turns around to look at Cal for, like, I don't know, like, 2-3 seconds.
Yeah.
And as soon as Cal takes a little too long to decide, Cal's out of sight, out of mind. Murdoch's turning back around. He's helping more people get on the boat.
Yeah.
Billy Zane turns around, walks away, or storms off. And I said, it is a little comical when he does that super dramatic swerve and the music kicks back in right when he makes the swerve.
Yeah.
Intense, like this super low piano that's just dum, as he turns.
It's like Jaws turning around and going back to attack the swimmers.
And he's got the eyebrows raised, yeah, and everything. He's going all out with this turn.
And then Lovejoy's in the background just, you know, straggling behind him.
That's what I thought was funny, too. I said, so in my notes, I said, Lovejoy watches Cal storm off to the other side of the ship. And he mutters, shit, to himself. And I said, this makes me feel like Lovejoy was hoping for Cal to get on that boat so he could be done with all of this personal drama.
Yeah.
But then when Cal chooses for this drama to continue, Lovejoy is like, oh God, here we go again.
It is, yeah, that was interesting too. Yeah, it's such a good, I really like this scene right here. There's just the whole moment. I liked it a lot. A lot to chew on.
Because really, it's like, what is Lovejoy thinking then?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Is he thinking, oh no, like Cal's going to get himself into more trouble, or I'm going to have to deal with this nonsense some more?
Well, in his head too, if he hates Jack, he's like, Jack has a better chance of dying if we just leave him behind on this ship. And, you know, if we take Rose with us, then he might find a way to come with us too. And like, I don't know, like... I hate Jack. I just want him out of my life.
Lovejoy is just president of the I Hate Jack yeah, Dawson fan club.
Totally.
Yeah, that's kind of a good way to think of it, if we're thinking of it like that. If Cal is reinserting himself into the situation with Jack, Lovejoy's like, I wanted to be done with this child.
Exactly.
So Cal makes his way across the bridge, and he's walking at an angle, of course, because the ship's on an incline.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew are telling him, sir, you can't come through here. Sir, you can't come through here. To both of them in a row in the same exact tone. That always stood out to me. Now, this is what you were touching on.
Yeah.
So in my notes, I said, I personally think that he chose to go after Rose because he wants to win, quote unquote, in some way. We actually see more of this later. And I say it gets a little bit more layered in the next scene. But I feel like the main source of his decision is not out of love for Rose, but a desire to beat Jack.
Yeah. And it's knowing him, that's what it is. I mean, there might be remnants of some sort of responsibility or love or whatever you call it for Rose. But most of it is his pride in wanting to beat the other guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And again, like speaking from this scene right now, because the next scene, like I said, it does get a little bit more layered. Billy Zane's performance is a little bit more interesting, you know, so there's more to talk about there. But right now, you know, if we're just viewing it as it is, that's what I've always thought. And even into the next scene, I still think that's the main source of everything he does, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he has to win. He has to be the one to come out on top. He cannot allow this poor guy to win over him. He just can't do it. That's more important to him than the safety of this lifeboat, this guaranteed safety of this lifeboat, which is kind of sad.
Yep.
So we see Ismay at the lifeboat now. He's all alone. He's apparently the last one left. He had just helped some people on. And he's saying, like, okay, splendid. Like, everyone's aboard. Like, great. And then he looks back to the boat, and he looks away, and he looks back to the boat. And he decides to hop into the boat. Now, as I was taking my notes, because, you know, as you're taking your notes, you start thinking, as I said, especially at midnight, you start thinking of other things. So I wrote down that technically, he didn't do anything wrong from a basic standpoint, because it's more of a question of ethics, right?
Yeah.
That's the Ismay situation. Because if he wasn't the head of White Star Line, he would have just been another male passenger who would have boarded a boat that was already letting men on.
Yeah.
But since he is the head of White Star Line, the conflict comes from, does he go down with the ship, with the captain and others who are employed by his business?
Yeah.
Or does he consider himself a passenger like everybody else? Because he referred to himself as such earlier in the movie when talking to Captain Smith, and he was trying to tell him to push the engines and whatever. And then he goes, of course, I'm just a passenger. I leave it to your good officers to decide what's best.
Yeah.
And then there's a deleted scene called Ismay Panics, which was apparently some testimony from Officer Lowe. He said that Ismay just started to freak out at one point and was telling them to lower away, and he just wanted to get people on the boats. And Lowe didn't know who he was at the time, and then later found out that he was Ismay. So in this deleted scene, you have Ismay freaking out, and he's going over to the lifeboats, and he's trying to lower them himself, and he's going like, lower away, lower away. And Lowe takes him, and he's like, throws him aside, and
there's no time to waste! Lower away! Lower away! Lower
hey!
Away!
Get out the way, you fool! Do you want me to drown a lot of them?
Do you know who I am?
You are a passenger, and I'm a ship's bloody officer! Now do as you're told!
Yes, quite right. Sorry, I...
leading up to this scene, he was just reminded that he was just a passenger, not special, not better than anyone else.
And he's using it as justification, probably, too.
Yeah. Because again, want to reference, yes, we just referenced something historical, but we are still thinking in terms of the character.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was presented in the movie. And I know we shouldn't, like, necessarily factor in the deleted scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does still give context to what the implications were when they were writing it and behind the scenes that we do see, you know?
Yeah. Also, there's not his, like, I guess you can say, okay, he is the head of the company, but it's not a flaw of the ship. The ship's not going down because of a flaw in the ship. It hit an iceberg. Like, that would have sunk any ship, especially back then. So I guess, like, he's responsible for this, for the Titanic itself and, like, its creation, but it's not like he was responsible for why it was sinking, I guess. Murdoch's a different story. Like, you know, what he does has a little bit more weight to it because he was involved in the situation. But so, I mean, yeah, it's a question of prudence. Like, should he stay on the ship? Like, is that what's right? You know, especially being in front of, you know, kids or whatever, if he was, but he was helping them on. So I don't know. It's definitely just a dilemma.
So this is what James Cameron had to say, which is, you know, something you kind of just touched on that I don't necessarily agree with.
Now here you've got Ismay getting into Collapsible Sea, and this really happened. He just kind of jumped on board, and even though he was probably the man most responsible for the sinking and for ultimately over 1,500 deaths, here he was getting away scot-free. And of course, he lived in shame the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, like, I don't know as much as James Cameron does about him and his role, obviously, but there might be a reason why he's saying that, I guess, but The film definitely portrays this moment as a man being descended into his own hell based off the music and just the look on his face.
And the descending of the boat as well.
And the descending of the boat, yeah. But I mean, like, obviously, like, everyone who gets on a lifeboat descends, which is why I like the all these little descents. Like, you watch Rose's mom go and you see her kind of disappear. Whereas this one, you're watching Ismay while he's descending, and you're watching Murdoch disappear up top. So it's more of like you're watching him go into his own hell, whereas, like, you're, I don't know, it's definitely makes it a different feeling when you watch it. And then the music, obviously.
Take them down. Keep it steady. Both sides together, steady. Keep it steady.
And the music definitely is trying to paint this as Ismay was making a wrong choice, which obviously is confirmed by James Cameron's quote there. But
and then this is what the historians had to say about it.
Ismay, they're getting into the Collapsible Sea. He claimed that there were no more women or children visible on the deck at all. It appeared to be deserted. And so he thought, why should one more life be lost? I might as well get in. I need to testify. I'm the president of the White Star Line. I need to. I have a duty to save myself. And, of course, the public did not view it that way.
No, of course not.
Yeah, so one thing there that I had never thought of before was that he has to testify.
Yeah.
That was an interesting thing that they said. Like,
yeah, someone does have to. It helps them kind of figure out what's happening. It brings closure also to a lot of families who lost people, if someone who knows what happened, who's in the room, is alive. And that is important. So, like, if no one survives, it's, especially back then, it's a lot harder to figure out what happened. A big reason why we do know a lot of the stuff we know is because people who are of importance or who are in the room were able to give their testimonies as well. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. Again, like, he was definitely convincing himself, I think, of why he should be saved, but I like whether or not it's not heroic by any means saving himself, but yeah, I could see someone being super guilty. It's survivor's guilt.
I mean, that's pretty much the narrative surrounding Ismay, is that, you know, he was ashamed for the rest of his life and everybody looked very poorly upon him for making this decision.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, my brain at midnight, I was like, he decided to save himself and live in a moment of panic when opportunity was right there. And I said, no one wants to die when you're in a fight or flight situation like that.
Yeah, it's the human decision. But there's a reason why we romanticize like the musicians, because they...
Of course.
They were like, we're going to provide a service for these people in a time of panic, maybe help calm them down, make right decisions, you know, or the people who were just, I'm going to die on this ship and help people on. And a hero is making the hard decision and knowing that that's the decision you need to make. I think in this situation, he was just a human making a, you know, you could say self-centered choice. But yeah, there's a lot of people who would have made that choice. But there are a lot of people who wouldn't have, so.
Oh yeah, and I meant to mention in the illustrated history book, as far as, you know, I guess you saying like rationalizations for Ismay, it says that, like at the inquiries and when asked and stuff, it says, overall, he maintained that he was no different from any other passenger on board the Titanic for her maiden voyage.
So. You could say, like, did he have to even be on the ship? Like, did he even serve a purpose on the ship? Like, he wasn't a captain. He wasn't a first mate. He wasn't a navigator. So, like, if he didn't need to be on the ship, then, yeah, you could say he was just a passenger, I guess. Because if he wasn't on the ship, nothing would have changed, and then he would have just lived because he wasn't on the ship, so.
So I also wanted to mention, when Ismay's boat lowers, the way Murdoch freezes when he sees him. So Murdoch's like doing his thing. He's like rubbing his hands together in the cold or something. And then he turns around and he sees Ismay sitting in the boat. And he freezes and he just stares at him for a minute. And Ismay turns his head away, like tries not to make eye contact with Murdoch at all costs. And just waits. But Murdoch decides, take them down. And that's when the music kicks in with the...
Yeah, like to Murdoch, I'm not going to make this guy do something that he obviously doesn't want to do. If he wants to be a coward, then I'm just going to let him dig his own grave, I guess.
Again, the characters in the movie as it is played. I wrote that, you know, Murdoch decides to let Ismay live with the choice he's made.
Yeah, yeah.
And take them down. Ismay knows that he's in the clear for a moment. Like, as soon as Murdoch says that, you can see him breathe a sigh of relief for a second, but then also shame, obviously. And then he has that slow glance upward as he goes down. And I thought it was funny because on the cast commentary, Jonathan Hyde, who plays Ismay, he said that his look upward at the end was because he thought he was losing his light for the shot.
That's great. That's awesome. I love it.
He was like, wait, what's happening? I'm losing my light. Am I still in the frame? Like, what's going on?
You're watching him break almost. Yeah, that's great. No, I love that. He's a great actor, by the way. He's really good.
And then I just thought it was funny because he said that and he just starts dying laughing. And then he goes, Jim said to me, oh, that was great. Why did you do that? And I said, I was losing my light. And then he said that Cameron said, oh, I thought it was something profound.
Yeah, oftentimes it's just breaking character.
That's really love good. That. Oh, I thought it was something profound. No, guess not.
Yeah.
So then right after this, there was another deleted scene called A Husband's Letter. And it, you know, it leads right into the next scene. So it would have cut back to Jack and Rose waiting for that boat. And a man had just finished like scribbling a letter and addressed it or wrote the name of his wife who's in Des Moines, Iowa. And he hands the note to Rose and says, will you get this to my wife in, you know, wherever, Des Moines, Iowa? Something. He just kind of goes off a little bit, says a little something about his wife. I heard someone say that some people thought the line was weird because he was like, oh, she's beautiful. Everyone asks me, oh, wow, is that your daughter? And I go, no, I'm just lucky. And I'm like, that's kind of creepy.
That is creepy.
Weird line.
It's very strange.
I mean, I someone tried to say that was one of the reasons why it was cut, I saw online, but I don't think that's true. James Cameron, I knew that there were the deleted scenes with commentary, and I couldn't figure out where to find them, and then I remembered it was on the Blu-ray, and I haven't watched my Blu-ray in forever because I couldn't get my Blu-ray player to work. So I just got it to work, so I was able to listen to this deleted scene with commentary. And James Cameron said that in this scene, it was basically supposed to be added time for Rose to be thinking of everything that's about to happen, because there was a little bit of lead up to the man giving her this letter where she looks to her side and she sees another couple who are preparing to part ways. And then the man comes over and gives her this letter, like, give this to my wife, blah, blah, blah. And then she just kind of gets frazzled, and then she turns around to Jack, and then the scene proper starts from when it cuts. So James Cameron said that Rose can see it coming, that the women are boarding and men are staying behind. She looks at couples saying goodbye, and it's all leading up to her being separated from Jack. But they removed this extra beat because they didn't need to show extra moments of Rose's anxiety during this buildup. He just said that Kate was strong enough as it was. They didn't need this extra 40 seconds or however long it was.
Yeah, because at that point, it's almost dumbing it down for the audience. The audience knows what's at stake, and they know she's stressed out already. So, yeah, mm-hmm. It was a good decision.
I get wanting to include it to, you know...
Yeah, me too.
Keep painting the picture of, you know, all the people who had been separated from people that they loved. But yeah, for the sake of the movie, pacing, everything like that, I get it.
Yeah.
That's where I have the end of the scene marked. It was a very, very short scene, but I still had 5 pages of handwritten notes about it. We still talked for at least an hour about literally only 1 minute and 30 seconds of actual movie, mm-hmm. I think.
You're welcome, folks.
So it is pretty crazy. We're officially under an hour left of movie. Nice. So...
home stretch.
Because we're kind of zooming through them now that we're on this schedule that I'm trying to stick to of like a bi-weekly sort of thing, if we could keep this up. Yeah, we're kind of zooming through and I'm like, whoa, pretty soon we're going to have, you know, 30 minutes of the movie left. Oh, and by the way, this is including end credits. So yeah, never mind. Because right now it says we have 59 minutes left, but subtract 7 minutes from that.
Are there any scenes that are like very long from here on out, or are they mostly just pretty short?
I mean, I feel like it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
Like, if we look at the Blu-ray scene selection, there's 20 scenes left.
We got another year left of this.
But I think you might have mentioned, either on the record or off the record, that a lot of the scenes, it's montage-y, kind of just the peril and everything going on and the distress. So, yeah.
We used to record, I don't know, 2 episodes... a week for talking.
Yeah, we used to try.
But yeah, we said a handful of times we've done 2 a week. I think one time we did 3, maybe.
Probably. Yeah.
We're getting into the meat of it now, so it's kind of harder.
We really are. And because of that, perfect segue, actually, I've realized that, you know, we're running out of time to get other voices to come on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like you said, we're really getting into the meat of it. So I figured now is as good a time as ever to maybe try to get some other guests on the podcast. And I'm mainly thinking right now just other fellow fans. So I have lined up a few people to come on and speak with us. And I'm very excited about them. I don't want to give them away just yet, but I think 2 of them, you guys, our listeners, are probably familiar with. So I'm very excited about that. One of them who will be on for the very next scene is someone that our listeners may also listen to, I think. That's what I'll say there without giving it away. Very excited about it. We are recording it.
Yeah.
On May 26th.
And then we confirmed Kate Winslet, too, right, in a couple weeks?
Right, right. That one slipped my mind. Forgot to mention that.
Jam Cam's coming on.
Jam Cam, yeah. The whole gang. But yes, so we have them on the very next episode, and then someone else to come on for a later scene, who I'm very, very excited about, that I'm sure if you like Titanic at all and that your internet knows that you like Titanic and the algorithm has set this up for you, basically, I feel like there's a high chance that you have seen this person pop up on your feed. So I'm very excited to have them on as well. But yeah, basically, as we're heading into this more heavy section of the film, this back end of the film, I feel like, number one, we're running out of time. And two, I feel like as things are getting heavier, more perspectives could be greatly beneficial for the conversation, I think.
Yeah.
Especially because we know each other pretty well at this point. I feel like...
Yeah, guys, we have nothing left to say.
I mean, I just feel like you probably yeah. know where I'm going to come at from
yeah,
things.
Yeah, totally.
And then I kind of maybe know some things you might say, but when we get a third voice in the mix, we have no idea where they're going to yeah. come at this stuff from.
It's angering, really.
No, it's funny, though, when they'll say something where I'm like, man, I wish I thought of that.
Yeah,
think of that? But yeah, so I am very excited about that because I do think that it really helps take a lot of our conversations to a new level sometimes. And I know we got like a lot of positive feedback on our episodes with Liz. I know yeah. we've gotten a few comments and emails that said it was really good having like a third voice in the mix.
Yeah,
I mean, funny. I feel like we should, you know, make the most of this while we can.
Yeah.
While we're still discussing the movie. Anyway, so I think that's all for this episode. I feel like this was kind of a historically heavy episode. Just as far as, you know, background information for everything we see going on. Because part of me feels like, wait, what did we even say throughout this whole episode? Just because the scene was so yeah. short. I'm like, wait, I'll find out when I listen back to it. But I hope we said enough. Yeah, I think we did. I think we said some interesting things. Looked at it from a few different angles.
Yeah.
Still, it just amazes me how this was still fun and that we still had so much to talk about, because it was like a minute 30 of actual movie. And I said, how is this episode going to go? Like, how long are we going to be able to talk?
I had 3 bullet points.
Yeah, you had 3 bullet points and I had 5 pages of notes.
I do better when I'm less prepared, I think. But
oh, man, but that's just funny. I didn't really know how this was going to go, but I think it still turned out pretty okay.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Follow us on all of the socials. Everything will be in the description of this podcast episode. Follow Ethan and I on Letterboxd. Send us an email, titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Leave us a voice message via the link at the very bottom of the description. That's just about it. And we will see you in the next scene.
See ya.